Okay. We'll give it a minute and then we'll start. Okay. So thank you so much, everybody, for joining me tonight for our pre-Shavuot learning session. And my topic is going to be Boaz and Brock Turner, a contrast for the Me Too era. So I want to be very forthright and clear that this is going to be a discussion that references sexuality and sexual ethics and assault and rape and things like that. So if any of those things is a disturbing topic for you, I will not be offended at all if anyone wants to leave this session and go to a different session. That's fine by me. So that's my little disclaimer to start off with. And so you may be wondering, how do these two things come to be together? How are they related? So what I'm going to do is put the link to the source sheet into the chat so that you have access to it. And then I'm also going to share my screen so that way you'll be able to follow along with me. But some people like to have it on their own. So if you would like, here in the chat is the link to the source sheet. There you are. And then I'm going to share my screen and you will see it in a moment. All right, there we go. Okay, so Boaz and Brock Turner, a contrast for the Me Too era. So one of the fun questions that people sometimes ask is, if you were to have the ability to marry any character from the Tanakh, who would you choose? And what I'm going to try to convince you of by the time we're done this evening is that Boaz would be a good contender to choose, and that Boaz would be someone that you might want to marry. And it has a lot to do with who he is as a character and who he is as a personality. But where I'm actually going to start is not in Megillat Ruth, but rather all the way back in Bereishit, in Genesis. There's a wonderful book called The Beginning of Wisdom, and Leon Cass is the author. And he explains that in Genesis, when it comes to uninstructed relations between man and woman, there are three elements of human erotic love: lustful sexual desire, the love of the beautiful and admirable, and generative love. And they coexist warily side by side, and they often come into conflict. So, therefore, he continues, none of the elements of human sexuality is unambiguously good. Possessive male lust for union can be degrading to woman, making her but an object of man's satisfaction, as we shall soon see in the story of Pharaoh and Sarah. Excessive love of one's own flesh means incest, as we see in the story of Lot and his daughters. Pride-filled love of beauty and concern for self-esteem can give rise to jealousy, discord, and bloodshed, as we saw in the rapacious conduct of the sons of God toward the beautiful daughters of man, which heralded the chaotic battles of the heroes. And womanly pride in her generative capacity can give rise to domestic strife, injustice, and impiety, as we see in Eve's declaration of the birth of Cain, who, bearing his mother's pride, kills his brother out of wounded pride. We also see it in the rivalry between Sarah and Hagar. And so what Leon Cass goes on to say is that one of the themes, or definitely one of the discussions in the book of Bereishit, is really a focus on sexuality and the sexual ethic. And he says that taming the dangerous female pride in her generative powers, her ability to give birth, is relatively easy. You can institute a prolonged period of barrenness before allowing childbirth, so the woman and her husband will understand that a child is not the woman's creation and possession, but an unmerited gift. And that's exactly what happens with Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel. But taming male possessive lust, or correcting man's pride-filled love of womanly beauty, or combating his indifference to or resentment of and flight from the need for procreation is vastly more difficult, as is inducing him to stand rightly with respect to his wife as the prospective mother of his children, educating a man to esteem woman as mother and to respect the task of moral and spiritual transmission is all the more difficult if that man is someone who's personally ambitious for fame and glory. And that's why this is something that actually has to be taught and where limits have to be set. And I think this is really fascinating because when I learned the Tanakh, the reason that I enjoy it so much is because I feel like the messages that we're learning are timeless and that they are meant to speak to us now, in 2020, in the same way that they spoke to people then. And so when you look at the Book of Bereshit and you see it not only as the creation story, which is what most people think of, but as a book that really deals with sexual ethics and sexuality as it's experienced by people who are not abiding by the Abrahamic code versus people who are abiding by the Abrahamic code, it becomes a really fascinating and interesting discussion. And if you think about it, there are many, many stories in the Book of Bereshit that deal with sexuality. And I won't list them all, but I'll just give you a few examples in case you're familiar with them. So obviously, from the very beginning, you have Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, and you know, the whole concept of man needing a helpmate. And then later on, we get into things like Abraham and Sarah and her being beautiful and then her being taken both by Paro and then by Avimelech. We have a repeat of that with Yitzchak. We have the rape of Dinah. We have Lot and what happens when the angels go to Sodom and they try to harm the people of Sodom, try to harm the people that they think are men, but that are really angels residing in Lot's residence. And Lot offers to give up his daughters instead, which does not make it much better. We have so many episodes. There's even midrashim that tie in and commentaries that tie in terms of, for example, when Yosef was purchased. We have the obvious story with Potiphar's wife and how she frames Yosef for sexual assault. But there's even an interpretation that says that Potiphar was homosexual and he bought Yosef to try to use him as some kind of slave for that purpose. And one of the things that's really interesting is that in some of these narratives, the question that is asked or that is stated is that, is there fear of God in that place? No, there is no fear of God. And where there is no fear of God, it can lead to very troubling outcomes in terms of sexual behavior. Since, you know, for example, the kidnapping or the taking of Sarah, yes, she was presented as being Avraham's sister and not his wife. And so there's a whole thing that you could get into on that, but still she's being taken and she didn't give consent. And the concept that there is no fear of God and that leads to a problematic sexual ethic is very, very prevalent in the Book of Bereshit. So if you look at the Book of Bereshit as kind of like an introduction of what human sexuality can look like in an unmitigated form and the difficulties and problems that can happen and how we try to refine it and develop it. And then we're going to carry it through now to our discussion tonight of Boaz and Ruth and so on. All right, so Brock Turner, as some of you may know, was an athlete at Stanford and he was a swimmer. And he was found behind a dumpster with a young woman who at the time was only known as Emily Doe, but who later on revealed her identity. Her name is Chanel Miller. And she was unconscious. What happened was these two bikers were biking by. They see this unconscious woman behind a dumpster. They see Brock Turner on top of her. They say, you know, what are you doing? They stop him. They hold him. She gets taken to the hospital. And there came a trial for Brock and Chanel. Read a statement, and you can click here later to read the full statement. But she says, "You don't know me, but you've been inside me, and that's why we're here today. One day I was at work scrolling through the news on my phone and came across an article. In it, I read and learned for the first time about how I was found unconscious with my hair disheveled, long necklace wrapped around my neck, bra pulled out of my dress, dress pulled off of my shoulders and pulled up above my waist. That I was butt naked all the way down to my boots, legs spread apart, and had been penetrated by a foreign object by someone I did not recognize. This was how I learned what had happened to me, sitting at my desk reading the news at work. I learned what happened to me the same time as everyone else in the world learned what happened to me. That's when the pine needles in my hair made sense. They didn't fall from a tree. He had taken off my underwear. His fingers had been inside of me. I don't even know this person. I still don't know this person. When I read about me like this, I said, this can't be me. I could not digest or accept any of this information. I could not imagine my family having to read about this online. I kept reading. In the next paragraph, I read something that I will never forgive. I read that according to him, I liked it. I liked it? Again, I do not have words for these feelings. Skipping a bit. At the bottom of the article, after I learned about the graphic details of my own sexual assault, the article listed his swimming times. She was found breathing, unresponsive, with her underwear 6 inches away from her bare stomach, curled in a fetal position. By the way, he's really good at swimming. Throw in my mile time if that's what we're doing. I'm good at cooking. Put that in there. I think the end is where you list your extracurriculars to cancel out all the sickening things that have happened. The night after it happened, he said he didn't know my name, said he wouldn't be able to identify my face in the lineup, didn't mention any dialogue between us, no words, only dancing and kissing. Dancing is a cute term. Was it snapping fingers and twirling dancing, or just bodies grinding up against each other in a crowded room? I wonder if kissing was just faces sloppily pressed up against each other? When the detective asked if he had planned on taking me back to his dorm, he said no. When the detective asked how he ended up behind the dumpster, he said he didn't know. He admitted to kissing other girls at that party, one of whom was my own sister who pushed him away. He admitted to wanting to hook up with someone. I was the wounded antelope of the herd, completely alone and vulnerable, physically unable to fend for myself, and he chose me. Sometimes I think, if I hadn't gone, then this never would have happened. But then I realized it would have happened just to somebody else. You were about to enter 4 years of access to drunk girls and parties, and if this is the foot you started off on, then it's right you did not continue. The night after it happened, he said I thought I liked it because I rubbed his back, a back rub. So what I want to point out to you in this statement, there's a lot of things, obviously, that are disturbing here, but her focus on, you don't know me, but you've been inside me. And then again, when she says, he said he didn't know my name, he wouldn't be able to identify my face in a lineup. So later on, when Chanel decided to write a book where she revealed her identity and shared her experience, she called the book, and I have it right here, Know My Name, a memoir. And the focus is very much on identity, right? If you're going to have sex with someone, you should probably know at the very least their name. You should probably also have them be in a state where they are not so inebriated or unconscious that they can't give consent. But anyway, this focus on Know My Name, that's where I want to go in terms of where we're going to look in terms of Boaz and Ruth. All right, so let's look at Boaz and the culture and the time period during which he lived. So you begin and you see, Vayehi bimei Shvot HaShoftim, Vayehi Ra'av Ba'aretz, in the days when the judges ruled. So we're being given a time period now, the time of the judges. And the question is, what was it like to live in the time of the judges? Was that a time period where people were very moral and proper and behaved well? Or was that a time period where things were not like that? You know, what was the sexual ethic especially like in the time of the judges? So what I'm going to do is bring you some examples from the book of Judges, which will reveal to you what things were like in that time period. So there's a famous judge called Shimshon, or Samson, and most people know about him because he's the mighty one. He's really strong, and he kills out a lot of Plishtim, which were the enemies of the Jews, and he literally brings the house down upon himself, and that's the last thing he does when he dies, is the entire house falls down upon his head because of his strength, and it crushes not only him, but everyone else inside the house as well. And so we see some interesting things about this Shimshon character in the Tanakh. You have Vayered Shimshon Timnata, Vayar Isha B'Timnata Mibnot Plishtim. So he sees this girl among the Plishti women, and he goes to his father and mother, and he says, I've seen this beautiful Plishti girl, Kehu Otali Li'isha, get her for me as a wife. Obviously, he doesn't know anything about her. You know, it's not like he spoke to the girl, at least not what it says in the Pasuk. All that it says in the Pasuk is Vayar Isha. He saw her. So what did he see? It seems logical to assume what he noticed was her beauty, right? He didn't have a conversation. He didn't know her as a human. It gets worse, though. You know, it starts off with this girl. Now we get to a different story with Shimshon. Vayelech Shimshon Azata, Vayar Sham Isha Zona Vayavo Eleha. He sleeps with a prostitute. And then much later on, Vayhi Acharekin, Vayehav Isha Benachal, Sorek Ushma Delila, who we know as Delilah. So you have all these stories with Shimshon, who's the judge at the time period, and who is a mighty warrior, and who does succeed in defending and you know, going against the Plishtim, but where he's following after all these beautiful women. And in the story with Delilah, his lust for this woman actually leads to his downfall, because this woman is able to persuade him to tell her the secret of his strength, and she betrays him to the Plishtim, and then the Plishtim sees him and they gouge out his eyes. Now, the fascinating thing is that in the rabbinic understanding, it's not random that they gouge out his eyes. We have this Mishnah. The Mishnah provides additional examples of people who were treated by heaven commensurate with their actions. Samson followed his eyes, which is basically a way of saying he followed his lust. You know, he saw beautiful women and he decided to go off and be with them. Therefore, he was punished measure for measure as the Plishtim gouged out his eyes. And this is a leader of the people. I mean, this is one of the people who was actually a Shofate. Then we have an extremely disturbing story of the Pilegesh Begiva. And so it's a long story that I'm only going to go over in short, but the men of the town in a certain town are a depraved lot. They gather about the house. They're pounding on the door. They say to the owner of the house, bring out the man who has come to your house so we can be intimate with him. And so it's kind of like a correlation. It's an echo scene of the scene that we have with Lot and his guests back in Bereishit. The owner says, don't do this. This man has entered my house. This would be an outrage. Look, you can have my virgin daughter and his concubine. Not that this is much better. You know, we read this story and we're horrified, but he thinks this is better. Okay. Anyway, the men would not listen to him. So the man who's staying over seizes his concubine, pushes her out the door. They rape her and abuse her all night long until the morning. They let her go when dawn broke. When he opens the door to let her back in, she's dead. And so what he decides to do is cut up her body into many pieces and send it out throughout the land. It leads to civil war because they want to punish the tribe of Benjamin because it was this tribe that had allowed this to happen. They take an oath that they won't allow their daughters to intermarry with the tribe of Benjamin. But later on, they regret that oath because they realize that then the tribe of Benjamin will not be able to continue. And you'll have a situation where instead of having 12 tribes in Israel, you'll only have 11. So they come up with a plan. The Benjaminites should resort to marrying women who weren't present when the oath was made. But since there's not enough of them, they should also resort to kidnapping women. You have this section at the end where we can't officially give our daughters to you as wives because we made an oath that we wouldn't do so. So therefore, go and lie in wait in the vineyards. When you see the girls of Shiloh coming out to join in the dances, you should go seize a wife from among the girls of Shiloh and go off to the land of Benjamin. And then we see that lawlessness is the order of the day because we have Bayamim Ahem Ein Melech B'Yisrael Ish Hayashar Be'enav Ya'aseh. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did as he pleased. Literally, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So when you read the book of Ruth, and you see that the very first sentence tells you it was set in the time period of the judges, what it's really telling you is that it was set in a time where the sexual ethic was horrific. I mean, bad things were happening. Even the leaders were doing things that were bad. And it was lawless. I mean, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. There was no centralized government. There was no king to force people to behave and hold them to some kind of standard. And one could argue, well, if I'm living in the time period of the judges, I'm going to be influenced by that culture of lawlessness and that culture where every single, you know, person, I can just look at them as a sexual object or I can look at what I can get from them. And what's interesting is that Barak Turner's father read aloud a letter at his sentencing hearing, and he talked about how Barak had a really hard time settling into Stanford. And one of the things he says, which is in bold here, in hindsight, it's clear that Barak was desperately trying to fit in at Stanford and fell into the culture of alcohol consumption and partying. This culture was modeled by many of the upperclassmen on the swim team and played a role in the events of January 17th and 18th, 2015. And then he goes on to say that, you know, the verdicts that have happened to Barak, his life will never be the one that he dreamed about and worked so hard to achieve. That is a steep price to pay for 20 minutes of action out of his 20 plus years of life. So the argument basically seems to be in his father's letter, Barak is a good kid who got influenced by a negative culture. He shouldn't really be held so accountable for his actions because the culture was just so bad and he fell into it. And, you know, he's 20 years old and it was only 20 minutes that he spent with behind a dumpster with Chanel. And why should he be punished so harshly? Now, the thing that's fascinating is that you could argue Boaz is in the exact same position as Barak. Boaz is living in a time period of judges where even the judges themselves are not necessarily behaving. The culture is problematic and lawless. And we get to this scene here in Perek Gimel, where Naomi says to Ruth, we have our kinsman Boaz. I want you to bathe, anoint yourself, dress up, and go down to the threshing floor. Don't disclose yourself to the man until he has finished eating and drinking.
When he lies down, note the place where he lies down, go over and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what you are to do. Ruth goes along with this, and we could have an entire other discussion about what is this scene, why does Ruth go along with it, but that goes beyond the scope for tonight. Anyway, Boaz eats and drinks. In a cheerful mood, he went to lie down beside the grain pile. She went over stealthily, uncovered his feet, lay down. In the middle of the night, the man gave a start and pulled back. There was a woman lying at his feet. "Who are you?" he asked. Right? Mi'at. And she replied, "I am your handmaid, Ruth. Spread your robe over your handmaid, for you are a redeeming kinsman." Now, this, in the plain reading of the text, is a seduction scene. This is a woman going in the middle of the night to a man, lying down at his feet, and potentially, if you wanted to rewrite the story starting from Pasuk Chet, you could have this end where the two of them have some kind of sexual union. But that's not what Boaz allows to happen because of what Boaz does in Pasuk Tet when he says, "Vayomer mi'at, who are you?" And that's what's incredible. And that's what pulled my attention when we were first looking at the statement that Chanel makes about Barak. She says, right, "You don't know me, but you've been inside me. That's why we're here today." And she talks again and again about how he didn't know her. He didn't know her name. He didn't know her identity. And to the point that her memoir is literally called Know My Name. And here's Boaz, who's living in an exact same kind of very problematic culture, but he decides to take that step and to say, "Who are you? Like, I want to know who you are. I want to know your identity." And now, to make it even more fascinating, if you look at who Ruth and Boaz descend from, it makes Boaz's actions in this scene even more unbelievable. So Ruth is a Moabite, and she's descended from Moab. Moab is a child who's born from the union of Lot and his daughter. Boaz is a descendant of Judah and Tamar. Both of those unions are very problematic. They feature deception, but they also focus on men who choose not to know the identities of the women that they sleep with. So in the story of Lot, to explain what happens, there's the destruction of Sodom, and his two daughters believe that it's the destruction of the world. Incorrectly, they believe this. And due to that, they think, well, we need to perpetuate the human race. So as distasteful as it may be, we're going to have to get our father drunk and sleep with our father so that we can have children and perpetuate humanity. And so they do it with very good intentions, right? They are doing it to make sure, yes. They're doing it to make sure that there will be a humanity to come. But the question is Lot doing it with those same good intentions? And the Gemara says no. The Gemara says a lot of things. First, it talks about Lot as a lustful person, that, you know, he lifts up his eyes, which is similar to Shimshon and his desire to focus on what's pleasing in his eyes. And then we also see this idea that Lot didn't necessarily realize when his daughter laid down with him, but by the time she got up, he knew what she had done, and yet he still drinks the next night, and he allows himself to be deceived again. So he basically chooses to be complicit with his own deception. That's what the Gemara says. And if you look at Yehuda and Tamar, the story there is that Tamar had been married to Yehuda's son. Now, his sons practice something called onanism, which is basically, rather than finishing within the woman, they didn't want to spoil her beautiful looks, so therefore they would finish outside of her and they wouldn't give her a child. God did not approve of this, and two of the sons died. Yehuda looked at it as, oh, you know, if I marry my sons off to Tamar, all my sons will die, so he didn't want to marry the third son off to her. Meanwhile, Tamar was betrothed to, you know, members of the family. It wasn't like she had options to go marry some other person. So she decides to be clever. She wraps herself up with a veil. When Yehuda sees her, he takes her for a harlot. He turns aside by the road and says, "Here, let me sleep with you," because he doesn't know that she's his daughter-in-law. She says, "What will you give me?" They arrange for a whole pledge. Once again, what's interesting is he doesn't ask her anything. He doesn't say, "Who are you?" He doesn't say, "What's your name?" Her identity, it just works off of his assumption. And his assumption is, she's a harlot. She's not my daughter-in-law. This is not a Boaz, right? This is not a Boaz who turns to the woman who has literally come down in the middle of the night to him and says, "Mi'at." So Yael Ziegler is a wonderful teacher who wrote a book called Ruth, From Alienation to Monarchy, which I highly recommend. And if anyone is looking for good reading material for, you know, Shavuot, this would be a great book. Maybe Rosenblum's has it. And so Boaz's query, who is this woman? Why does Boaz tremble? The word chared in Tanakh generally indicates a frightened response, often due to a sudden realization of threatening or awesome circumstances. Why is Boaz so frightened? Several possibilities are raised by biblical commentators. Maybe Boaz feels physically endangered by the unexpected presence of a strange person in the field at night. Possibly he's afraid of the prospect that he will not be able to overcome temptation and will sin with this woman. Yet he allays the sexually charged atmosphere and he said, "Who are you?" And she said, "I am Ruth, your maidservant. Spread your wings over your maidservant, for you are a redeemer." The significance of this moment cannot be overstated. Instead of allowing the situation to advance toward a sexually satisfying conclusion, Boaz inquires the identity of the woman who lies seductively at his feet. How does Boaz accomplish this? From where does he find the restraint and reserves of energy that enable him to resist this human temptation? And so the thing is that in general, throughout the book of Ruth, and if you read it over, you'll see this, there's a theme of asking about identity, right? When he first sees Ruth, he asks, "Who is she?" And the overseer just says, "Oh, she's a Moabite young woman. She's a foreigner, nothing more." The fact that Boaz recognizes her as someone beyond that is already impressive. And so in each chapter, there's something else. Chapter 2, he combats the perception that she lacks a name and an identity beyond her Moabite status. Chapter 3, he combats the perception that Ruth is simply a woman. Boaz's query allows Ruth to restore her identity and elevates her above a mere sexual object. By inquiring after Ruth's individual identity, Boaz demonstrates that in this period, rife with the treatment of women as sexual objects, someone has mustered the capacity to recognize a nameless woman as a subject. Right? So this is an actual person, this woman lying at my feet, not just something that I can enjoy or use or anything like that. So in this way, Boaz begins the process of mending this debauched and socially chaotic period. And so when Ruth identifies herself, Boaz's query gives Ruth the opportunity to identify herself in a situation in which she has presented herself to him as a sexual object, turning her from object to subject. In prompting Ruth to employ the word anochi, Boaz allows Ruth to express self-definition. So where I wanted to go with this is, first of all, there's so much more that could be said. So if this interested you at all, again, I highly recommend this book, Ruth, From Alienation to Monarchy. Wonderful, wonderful book. And she develops this concept further. But things that I think can resonate with us from this story, from Megillat Ruth, right? A, don't be complicit in a corrupt culture. So when you think about the Me Too movement, nearly half of the men that were brought down by Me Too were actually replaced by women. And a lot of the problems that were brought to light by Me Too had to do with people being complicit. They pretended not to know. They pretended not to see what was happening. With Harvey Weinstein alone, you had all these people who were aware of what he had done, but who covered for him or made excuses for him. And so it's similar to Lot's complicity when it came to sleeping with his daughters, according to the Gemara's understanding. At the beginning, he didn't know. But once he did know, he decided not to know. You know, he pretended it away. He pretended it out of existence. Now we get to identity, right? Brock Turner didn't ask or care about the identity of the person he was with. Boaz turns all of that on its head, right? He wants to know who is with him. Seeing others, right? Here we're focusing on seeing others as individuals within a sexual context. But it's important to always seek to see others and understand where they're coming from and to look at them as layered, multifaceted people and not as objects. And lastly, redemption is possible. So both Ruth and Boaz descended from people who demonstrated sexual selfishness, right? When it came to Lot and his daughters, not necessarily the daughters, they had the best of intentions, but Lot himself, the way he behaved was not acceptable. And in terms of Yehuda and Tamar, right? Yehuda never asked Tamar who she was, what her name was. None of that was important to him. Also, they're living in the time period of the judges where I've shown you that lawlessness prevailed, and it would have been very easy to make the argument, well, everyone around me is behaving badly, so why shouldn't I? But their relation is redemptive, and it leads to the Davidic dynasty. And obviously, the Davidic dynasty is fraught with its own stories. It's not so simple. But when we think of the Davidic dynasty, we tend to think of overall, you know, good things and positive takeaways. So that's what I've got for this evening. If anyone would like to share comments or questions, that's fine. Otherwise, it's 9:30 and you may need to go, and that's also fine.
I did read somewhere this weekend that We have been in quarantine as long as Brock Turner spent in jail.
It was a very, very light sentence. He only spent 3 months.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yep. This is true. I hope you have a wonderful Shavuot to everyone here and a meaningful Shavuot. And be well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good night.
Have a good night. Regards.
Be well.
Thank you.
Thank you.